Hey there, everybody. You are listening to This Show Is So Gay. I'm your host, Ken Schneck. This is episode number 252. As always, you can get in touch with us by dropping us a line. Send that email on over to ken@thisshowissogay.com. Stroll on over to thisshowissogay.com to learn all about the fun things happening with our little gay radio show that could. You can follow us on Twitter. We're tweeting all the time now. But, of course, go to the Facebook. Like us there, because we sure as heck like you. What a show we have for you this week. We must get started with our first guest. Kristen Ellis Henderson is a guitarist, songwriter, and founding member of Antigone Rising, who I freaking love. You guys know that because she's been on the show before. She's also the co-author of the memoir Times Two, Two Women in Love and the Happy Family They Made. And she maintains a blog, Hanging with Hendo, where she voices opinions simply by telling her own personal stories on just any topic you can think of. She and her wife are vocal advocates on LGBT issues. Antigone Rising has toured with the Rolling Stones, Aerosmith, the Allman Brothers, so many more. They have a new project out that you, yes, you can help fund, and we'll tell you how. The last time she was on the show, we found out that Antigone Rising wrote a song about me called She's Not Innocent, so let's see what we can find out now. Kristen, welcome back to This Show Is So Gay.
Hi, Ken, the muse of my band.
By the way, I don't even want to continue this conversation because I need to go update my resume to put that on there.
Okay, off you go. Thank you so much for having me back on the show. I just love chatting with you.
So much to talk about. Are you ready?
Oh, I'm so ready.
Well, remind everyone, you are a musical artist. We start with you as we start with all of our musical artists, and you did this last time. We'll make you do it again. Tell everyone why the medium of music to get your voice out there.
You know, that's just always been what I've gone to, you know, naturally. My sister and I have always been musical, and so it was an easy way for us to express ourselves, you know, artistically. So it's always been my chosen, you know, means.
Nice. Well, we've had so many singer-songwriters on the show, folks who are in solo acts, and you are not a solo act, and I don't want you to say that you are because that could be the demise of your band on the air. Yeah, that would be bad. Talk to me about how you adjust your own voice, what it is that you have to say by being a member of a band.
Here's the thing about that. First of all, if I ever do launch a solo career, I promise you I will make the announcement on your show.
Nice. I'm holding you to it.
Okay, but that'll never happen.
Okay.
I have always been, seriously, it's in my DNA. My sister and I are best friends. We always have been. We grew up together. And I'm more of a team sport type player.
Oh.
You know what I mean?
Yeah.
I like being part of a team. So in that sense, I've always just very naturally migrated toward a band. And I'm just very comfortable with, like, you know, majority rules. Though I do tend to sometimes be the captain of the team. You know, I love the idea of traveling in a pack and having each other's back, and it's like a real kind of family kind of vibe. So I much prefer it that way. I've never had an inclination to do go solo, if you will. I mean, like, when I think about doing a solo record, honestly, this is how I picture it. I picture if I did a solo record, I would co-write the songs with Nene, who's our lead singer. I would record them in her house. She would produce. I would get Dina, our drummer, to play drums. So it's like, okay, that's not a solo record. Like, that's how codependent we are. You know what I mean? That's how I think. My solo record would be done with my band, so that's not a solo record.
Although I'm a little concerned in your explanation at how easily you just dropped your sister.
No, my sister's a given. So
I don't want family discord started on this show, you know, the episode where you announced your solo career.
I know, no.
Okay.
And, yeah, so my solo career consists of my entire band being with me the whole time through my solo career.
Now, in having followed you guys for so many years, since I first heard you in that Starbucks and just being obsessed with your music, it doesn't strike me, as compared to some of the other bands we've had on the show over the years, that you guys have, like, the behind-the-music drama that some of the other bands have.
Well, good. I'm glad that it doesn't strike you that way.
Okay, let's leave it there.
let's leave it at that. There was definitely a time where we certainly did. I don't think that this incarnation of Antigone Rising has it. But we have a more interesting story. We don't need drama and discord to make the story interesting.
Exactly.
I think.
Exactly. Well, let's get right into the music. You just put up a whole blog post. I love Hanging with the Hendo. I read it.
Oh, thank you. Thank you. Thank you, Ken.
We will ask you the question that you asked yourself. How does Antigone Rising fit into the music industry?
Yeah. Well, I mean, we don't. There's no music industry. What music industry?
Exactly.
There's my question to you. I've now turned the question on you. I just think that it's a confusing thing, the music industry, isn't it? It's just a mess right now. I mean, nobody knows what to do. The industry doesn't know what to do with themselves. And, you know, people are downloading music. People want it for free. They don't want to pay for it.
Right.
So, you know, my feeling is, while the music industry is chasing their tails, Antigone Rising is over here on Long Island, and we're just figuring it out how to do it on our own.
Yeah.
We don't need, you know, to be part of that industry.
So well written. You wrote this, quote, "Each one of our songs helps us earn a living, so each song is really important to us. We aren't going to twerk to make sure people hear the songs because we hope our songs sound better than what our butts might look like in the air. The music industry that I struggle so hard to define has basically been smashed to smithereens, at least from my vantage point, so we're just cutting out that whole hot mess piece of the puzzle."
Did I write that?
You totally wrote that.
Yeah, I know. I wrote it. I didn't even pause. I don't even think I hit a wrong key while I was typing. It was a mile a minute. It's so true. I mean, it's very true. And here's the thing. Like an artist like Miley Cyrus or Katy Perry, and don't get me wrong, I actually quite like Katy Perry, and I don't mind Miley Cyrus so much. I think they're really talented. I think they've got great voices. I relate to them as artists. I think they're really talented. I think that they are given great songs, even if they co-wrote them, and I use my quote fingers when I say co-wrote, because they're being put in the room with, like, the greatest songwriters in the business, and they're co-writing songs and giving co-writer credits, whatever that is. That's fine. Here's the thing. When their major label puts out their album, their 10-song or 12-song CD or whatever it is nowadays, it doesn't matter because everyone is hearing the hit, and they're going and they're just downloading that one song. So now there's these 12 songs that cost however much to make and produce, and then like 11 songs just go to total waste because no one's downloading albums anymore. They're downloading the songs that they like. And that's if you're lucky they're downloading the songs you like instead of figuring out ways to steal them or stream them instead on Spotify or Pandora or another, you know, medium like that. So, you know, I don't have a major label who's like keeping up, sustaining us on the road or in any way. So every song for me really matters. It matters that when a fan downloads our music, they're paying or at least attempting to in some way help fund us. I just think the music industry has changed in this sense. And now artists are doing these like crowdfunding type campaigns.
Yeah.
So, you know, in a sense, and this is going to sound, I feel like I'm going to sound like I'm a socialist when I say this.
Go for it.
I don't want to offend anyone, you know, politically. But I do believe that there are certain artists that I am a fan of or that you might be a fan of who you have to go now out of your way and maybe spend a little more money on them because in turn someone else is going to spend money on another artist. So say you give Sean Colvin $100 one year to make her new music or whatever it is she has to do. It's because you love Sean Colvin, and so because you did that, now you're streaming Patty Griffin on Spotify. I just think it all works out in the end. Everybody gets a little bit of the pie,
yeah.
But it all works out for the artists because that's the only way we can fund ourselves. Do you know what I mean?
Totally.
So whereas you might not be giving to Patty Griffin, you've given $100 to Sean Colvin, and hopefully there's a Patty Griffin fan who's going to give $100 to her, and they're going to show up to Sean Colvin's shows. It's just different. Like every time you spend money on an artist now, it's like life or death for the artist, you know?
I have to tell you, I mean, I understand the concepts, but in my happy place, I just in my head went to a concert that had Antigone Rising, Sean Colvin, and Patty Griffin.
I know. Wouldn't that be so great?
Yes.
I know.
Yes,
so
it totally
anyway,
would.
I don't know if that makes sense, that philosophy of mine. It does to me. I know that like our maybe 500 or 600 really diehard fans are willing to pay a little more than $10, what it would cost to buy my album, in advance. So that I can make a record and be able to market and promote it. And
yeah.
I've got to be able to count on that now. As do bigger artists even. There are those people willing to spend a little extra money on us because on the other end, they are getting other artists for much less on Spotify who maybe they aren't as passionate about. But in some way, I've gotten, you know what I mean? I don't know.
Yeah. Well, let me ask you this, because one of the things about you that you may either like or not, and I'm kind of curious, is that I do not divorce your voice outside of Antigone Rising from Antigone Rising. And you are quite prolific outside of Antigone Rising with your views, with your writings. Is that okay that I put those two things together?
Absolutely. I think that Antigone Rising is literally in my DNA. I mean, it's genetically encoded in me. You know, I know that through the years, people have come and gone from Antigone Rising, and I don't want you to misunderstand. I don't think that I am Antigone Rising. My sister and I are certainly Antigone Rising. At this point, Dina certainly is too, but, and Nini is as well. She's been with the band for almost 5 years, but
yeah.
People have come and gone from this band since 1992, since I was in college. I've seen a lot of people come and go, and if I go, I die. That's kind of how I feel.
You were in college when you were 12?
Exactly.
See what I did there?
Yeah.
That was good.
Perfect. You're my new publicist. So anyway, my point is that it's such a huge definer of who I am. This band is so tied to my identity.
Yeah.
Even as a person, I mean, as you know. So,
well, let's talk about your voice with the band, outside of the band. So much going on. By the way, so much has happened even in the past year since we've talked. First, you, my friend, were named one of the most powerful quotes from LGBT icons and allies in 2013 from BuzzFeed.
I know, that was nice, wasn't it?
Let me read the quote. You wrote, quote, "I'm kissing my wife on the cover of Time because the mother of a gay kid might see it and finally come around to letting her son or daughter back in the house because it's time for every American to have their civil rights." Pretty good stuff.
Yeah, thank you.
And look how much has happened, even just in the past year. How do you wrap your mind around all of the developments between even when you were on the show last May?
I know. Wow. It's pretty mind-boggling.
Yeah.
On the one hand, and on the other hand, there's still a lot to do, you know. So I don't want to lose sight of that. But I love to be able to like raise a glass and celebrate. It's like every time I go on Facebook or something, it's like another state
has right.
decided we can be married. It's really magical. So, you know, I'm all for it. I love the momentum. But you know, on the flip side, there's some wacky stuff still going on. You know, what just played out in Arizona.
Unbelievable.
Right? And then let go beyond that. Globally right now, it's terrifying what's happening around the globe.
Yeah.
For our LGBT brothers and sisters. And it's really, really, it's frightening. It's like almost hard to take. So we got to figure all that stuff out.
Yeah. Now, if I may talk a little bit about your personal life, quite a bit has changed in the past year with regard to your wife's employment.
Yes, I say.
Tell it for people who don't know, what happened?
Well, Sarah, my wife, Sarah Kate, she worked in the magazine industry for a long time in marketing, and about a little over a year ago, she left publishing and really wanted to strike out into another field. She wasn't sure what she wanted to do, but she was trying to work it out. And in June, we marched in the Gay Pride Parade. It was right around the right time of DOMA. You know, Edie Windsor on the great Supreme Court victory. So we decided we wanted to go into the city with the kids and march in the Pride Parade, and we marched with GLAAD because GLAAD is an organization that we've worked very closely with in the past. We wrote a book together, Sarah, Kate, and me, about the kids and being pregnant at the same time, and GLAAD really sort of walked us through that process of how to handle media interviews and questions and things.
Yeah.
And then they went on to sort of tap us quite often to do media interviews when equality was happening in New York State. So we've worked closely with them. So we marched with them in the Pride Parade, and it became obvious that they were looking for a new president, head of GLAAD. And Sarah turned to me at Gay Pride, and she said, "It's my job. This is my
job."
And so she just went for it. And sure enough, they voted her in as the president and CEO of GLAAD. And she started the first of the year, or the second, January 2nd. So she's become, like, the busiest person. She's like a ghost in our house now. She's just traveling at the speed of light. And she's changing the world. And it's pretty awesome.
Now, how does that affect you? Again, as I said, you are quite prolific in your views, and you're engaged with these issues. But I would imagine that you would have to negotiate some of these conversations at home just so that it's not 24/7.
Oh, definitely. That's for sure. And, you know, it is that way. She is literally 24/7 now on the issues facing the LGBT community. So it's like, I can't believe the things that I'm finding out just from her.
Oh, I bet.
We don't even know are happening in towns and, you know, cities and what's happening. So anyway, I don't mind it. It's kind of fun, and it's where we are right now, and it's important. So we do talk a lot about LGBT issues in our house.
Has she said to you, listen, you are now the wife of the president of GLAAD. I need nothing to be due to the whiskey.
That's exactly right. Yeah, she does appreciate if I run things by her every now and then, if I'm going to go step too far out.
Okay.
But for the most part, I think even GLAAD knew when they hired her who she was married to. So, you know, we got to...
I love that was part of the vetting process.
Yeah, they knew who she was married to, so...
Listen, you have a lot of strengths, but let's talk about your wife for a second. That's awesome. That's awesome.
Yeah, yeah. Amazing. She's awesome. She's totally awesome.
Now, it looks to me, and I'm feeling pretty confident in this conclusion, it looks to me like you had a pretty okay time there on the Olivia Equality and Leadership Cruise.
Yes, we really did.
Have you done a cruise before?
We have. We have done a cruise before. We did the Rock Boat with... There's a band called Sister Hazel, and they host something
of course.
Called Rock Boat.
Yeah.
And that is literally a floating festival, nonstop floating musical festival, music festival. So they've got about 30 or 40 artists, bands, singer-songwriters on this one ship. And for 4 or 5 days, it's literally, you're just swapping stages all over the boat. It is pretty wild. So that is an awesome thing to do. But the Olivia cruise was a little more... you know, it was obviously about more people on vacation, and there was entertainment on the ship. So we were one of a few other artists that, you know, so everybody had like a specific night that they performed on. We ended up performing 2 of the nights. But the focus of the cruise, of this particular cruise, was equality and leadership. So it was the Women's Equality Leadership Cruise. Edie Windsor was on the boat with us, Greta Kammermeier. So it was like tingling the whole time. I was just tingling the whole time.
Wow.
You're constantly moved, constantly. It was just really, really informative and a really happy place to be.
Well, not that I'm about to change the name of my show to This Show Is So Indigo Girls, but I could at any minute because that's how much I love them. How cool was it hanging out with the Indigo Girls?
I mean, it's always, we've played with them before, and it's just like they blow my mind.
Yeah.
They're so good, and they are such a huge inspiration for us. You know, their vocal harmonies are, I mean, I think they are for so many, but, I mean, all we do is study what they do, you know. So to any time we get to play with them, and then they invited us up to perform with them on the cruise, so that was so exciting. We were singing on Closer to Fine. And
oh, my gosh.
It was such a trip. Yeah, it was such a trip.
I've done it. It's just they've never heard it.
Yeah, yeah, I know. Everybody's done it, right? We've all done it. That's what was so fun about it. It was like when we were up there singing Closer to Fine with the Indigo Girls, you know, we're singing, you know, you make up your own harmonies, whatever you do. We have our own harmonies. We have them all set in stone. I mean, we are so good at singing Closer to Fine. You can't even believe it. And you can see the look on their faces. Like, what? I'm like, do you know how many times we've sung this song? A trillion times. We've sung it maybe more than you. Like, you're kidding me?
That's,
and they were
awesome.
Like, your harmonies. And I was like, we were well practiced. Trust me. We are a well oiled, Closer to Fine machine.
Who isn't at this point?
That's what I'm saying. Who isn't? We sang that song to death for them on stage.
I love it.
Are you kidding me? I'm going to get called up on stage by the Indigo Girls. You're darn right I'm going to be ready.
You need me to be Michael Stipe? I'm on it, Amy Ray. Bring me up.
Amen. I love it. Are you on fire?
I love it.
Oh, man, that would have been great.
Well, I will tell you that I did share an Antigone Rising moment with my parents this weekend.
Oh, that's nice.
They came to Cleveland for the first time, and I was driving them around Cleveland, and I just had my phone playing random music, and that was the whiskey came on, and my mom said, can you pause it for a second? I said, sure, and I paused it, and she said, is there something you want to tell us? Have you been doing things that you regretted? I had no idea what she was talking about. That's how much ingrained that song is.
Right. She's like, why do you love this song?
This is a metaphor, isn't it? No, it's not. It's Antigone Rising. Well, the new project is called Whiskey and Wine, Volumes 1 and 2. And as you said earlier, folks can go and participate in the project. You know, this really is kind of this new age where not just about how musical artists can be supported in diverse ways, but the great part about this and why I love talking about it all the time is that we, as the listeners, feel like we have enabled it in some way, that we have access to you in this really cool way that we've never really had before in just buying a CD.
Right. Absolutely.
So everyone can go to pledgemusic.com/projects/AntigoneRising, and we'll provide that link. And what can we get by participating?
Well, I guess it depends on what level you pledge at, but everyone gets the download of Volume 1, Whiskey and Wine Volume 1. So what we're doing in 2014 is basically we're taking a full-length album and we're splitting it in half. We're releasing half of it in March and the other half in October. And our thinking behind that, and there is a strategy behind that thinking, it's that in this industry now, people put out entire CDs and 9 of the 10 songs go to waste. So by splitting it up and going 5 songs at a time, we're actually going to try and really create this experience where we sort of celebrate each and every song. So we're going to go 5 songs at a time. We're going to try and create videos, accompanying videos, stylized as best we can,
yeah,
for each and every song. And we're going to, you know, try this new approach and really make it more about all the songs so that we're bringing you into the entire CD, EP, and we want you to want the whole record. So anyway, go to pledgemusic.com and check it out, see what you think. And if you like what we're doing and if you like the way the songs sound, we have some samples of some of the songs that will be on the upcoming record. As soon as you pledge, and the minimum pledge is $10, you'll get the first EP download for free with that initial pledge. You also get access to this whole world on Pledge Music that is for pledgers only. So as soon as you back the project, you become sort of like a VIP person. So you get this behind-the-scenes opportunity to see us. We're posting videos and footage from photo shoots and sessions in the studio, and there's actually an official video on there for one of the songs on the record that no one has seen unless you've pledged. So there's this whole little world, this little community going on of people who have pledged, and they get access to certain things too. So it's kind of fun in that way if you're like a real fan of a band, or it's a really interesting way to get a better look inside what a band is doing.
And we must mention, once you reach your goal, which, by the way, you're getting pretty darn close to, and I'm going to help that along tonight, you plan to donate 5% of your earnings to GLAAD.
That's right. So we got to get to that goal. And that's what I love about Pledge Music, too, is that the way they give artists the opportunity to sort of incorporate something that they hold near and dear, you know. And it does make people giving, you know, just, I mean, I get it. We're a band. It's like everybody needs money. People, you know, there's charities for this and that, so many things, you know. And I know, you know, music is important. I really do believe that. And I believe that, you know, people should be able to access music that they love. And this is really the best way to do it in this paradigm, the way the business has fallen out.
Nice.
These Pledge Music, you know, type of sites are really enabling artists to keep making music, which I think is so great. But I do think it is important to have this component where the artist is able to give to an important charity, because, you know, I don't want to lose sight. I'm like, you know, asking people for money, but I want to be sure that it's, you know, we're doing good things with it and making great music.
Love it. Love it. Well, Antigone Rising is going to be in Boston on March 7th. You're going to be in Northampton at my beloved Iron Horse. I just moved from Northampton area to Cleveland, so I'm going to miss you at the Iron Horse, but I'm hoping there'll be some Cleveland dates coming up.
Definitely, there will be. We're hoping so. Once we reach this goal in our Pledge Music campaign, we're definitely planning on touring much further into the U.S., so we definitely want to get back out to Ohio this year.
And just to be clear, the solo campaign, the solo record, that kickoff is in Cleveland.
That's absolutely right. That CD release party will be in at your house, actually.
So excited. Oh, God, I'm going to invite Amy Ray right now. Kristen, love having you on the show. Everybody's got to go to AntigoneRising.com. We'll link you up with the Pledge Music campaign. Go see them on tour. Go download their music. It can facilitate a conversation between you and your mom. I highly recommend it. Say hi to your lovely wife and your beautiful children.
Ken, I love being on your show, so if you want me weekly, I'm available.
I'm not turning that down.
All right, right on.
Thanks so much, Kristen.
Take care, Ken.
Smoke on the street, fire in the water, there was a need.
folks, and we are back. Well, just the other day, I was trolling around online and stumbled onto a Huffington Post piece called Everything That's Wrong with Gay Dating Apps in One Extended Profile. It entertained me, but it also hit a nerve, a spot that it was clearly hitting with some other folks as well. What better way to deconstruct this 363-word entry than speaking to the gent who penned it? I counted, David. Then speaking with the gent who penned it. David Toussaint is the author of DJ, The Dog Who Rescued Me, The Gay Couple's Guide to Wedding Planning, Toussaint, and Gay and Lesbian Weddings, Planning the Perfect Same-Sex Ceremony. He's also a professional playwright and actor, and now he's here with us. David, welcome to this show, Is So Gay.
Hi, thank you. It's nice to be here.
Did you not know it was 363 words?
I did not pen it,
no. Oh, it was that. Well, before we even get into the piece, talk to me about what inspired you to string this together.
I will admit, I'm on Grindr, and I'm on Scruff, and I was looking at them, and I found myself getting more and more amused by just some of the extremely negative things written on there in men's searches for other men. And I do understand that it's a hookup site primarily, but it's when you go on it, you tend to find this no, 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 none of this, none of that, none of that. And after a while, I kind of found myself thinking, you know, charmed. Like, I don't want to meet any of you people because you sound so unappealing. Usually, the ones that have the most no's are the ones that are headless torsos with these great bodies, so you don't even know if they're real. But I figure if they are real and it's no, you know, it's all this, and I won't do this. Don't even bother me if I blah 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 blah. I figure, well, why are they on Grindr so much if they're so good looking? Can't they just walk out in the street and flag anyone down?
Well, that's part of the question. Here's a little snippet of that. Quote, plan to Skype first so I know you're worth my time.
Dates that's prefer- real, too.
That's yeah. real. I had no idea.
That's one of the ones I found that guy was on there. Somebody wrote on one of the – I love reading the comments for this because they're really funny. But somebody asked me if the profile was real. And I did say it was a composite. But that one I found, and that was a headless torso. He's probably still on there. He lives near me. He's probably my neighbor. And it said, yeah, I will, you know, be prepared to Skype so I can see that you're the real thing or whatever first. You know, his was just no, 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 no.
Wow. Must have a great sense of humor, no liars, I'll know your real age, no short guys, and then my favorite, no bars, non-drinkers.
It's just no's. It's no's and no's. And all those things, some of those things are not bad. You know, somebody wrote to me or wrote in a comment, there's nothing wrong with writing no P&P, which is obviously party and play, and I agree. And it's certainly okay to say drug and disease free and these other things, but it's just all these labels. And how do you find a match when you set when you make these preset labels about everyone? You know, no short guys, no tall guys, no old guys, no too young guys, no twink, you know, what is your guy? And ultimately, it seems like we're looking for a better version of ourselves that probably doesn't exist.
Well, that hits on it, because I was reading through the comments, and again, the piece just came out, so there's going to be more and more comments, and we hope our listeners go and check it out, and we'll provide a link. But it does beg the question, is it something that perhaps is wrong with the people or with the medium?
I think we in the internet age create fairy tales, and I've written about this in other forums. I think we, ever since AOL started and Man for Men chat rooms became popular in the late 90s, I think it was, I think we go online and we read words and we see a picture, sometimes real, sometimes not, and we haven't even heard a voice, and we imagine our perfect dream man to go along with this. We create him online, and I think that's happening more and more, and he doesn't really exist. And I think that's, dream men do exist, but they don't fit into these perfect Ken doll six-pack guys that we see all over the internet, and they're not perfect, and they don't have all these qualities that we want, which we could only get in a robot. And I think that's happening more and more.
Although it then prompts the next question of, are these apps for dating or are they for hookups? Can they be for both? It's something that we're all still trying to figure out.
You know, I'm always surprised, and one of the other things I saw was a lot of no hookups. But then, you know, it's a picture of a man's, you know, or something like that, or they're sending you pictures like that. So there's a double, or they want pictures of your, or they want, you know, all these shots of you, and they want you to unlock, which is the big thing on Scruff. And there's that's another sort of double thing going on, or a double standard. I don't know if that's the right expression, where we want love and ultimately we want a long-term relationship. But the pictures that these guys often send are of themselves half naked, and they want to see that immediately.
Right.
And so how can you be searching in this medium for a long-term relationship if that's what you're advertising, if that's what you're asking for?
Right.
Putting so many boundaries on it. You can't be this way. You can't be too dark. You can't be too blonde. You can't be too old. It seems like, you know, it's like they're looking for a 33-year-old man with the perfect height, the perfect amount of facial hair, the perfect job, the perfect something, the perfect amount of, you know, no faults. And then they say a long-term relationship, and as I wrote in the piece, at the end they often say can't host. So there's something weird going on there, because they're not really in a position to have a long... How can you not host and be wanting a long-term relationship? Or they say discreet. You know, what does that mean, but they want a long-term relationship? I think people are putting out their fantasies and their desires in a, you know, quote-unquote safe place. And for all we know, they're married, and they do want a long-term relationship, but they're also horny as hell because they are men.
And, right.
And, you know, it's out there. It's so easy to access sex. So I think it makes it harder to be serious about romance in this kind of environment.
David, sometimes I can't host because I just don't feel like tidying up. I think you're reading into it too much. My boyfriend's away for the week. I just don't feel like cleaning up. That's what it is. It's a little confusing. And so we're going to provide the link to this. We want everybody to check it out, and we love when people comment, and that's how we interact. And you're one of those people like me who clearly is reading the comments, because you comment back, which sometimes I struggle with on Huffington Post. When I put my pieces up, I'm like, oh, God, I don't feel like interacting with some of these people.
Well, sometimes I think it's best to stay out of it, because
–
somebody told me a long time ago, you know, never interrupt somebody unless they blatantly misrepresent you or write something about you that is untrue,
right,
or it becomes personal. And that, as you know, happens in this day and age on the internet. And I didn't really see that on this. I thought it was obviously there's a general level of people being exasperated with hookup sites, even though some of the comments, and I agree, they have a very good side to them. I'm not saying don't use them, and obviously the piece is tongue in cheek, but I think there's a general feeling that something's slightly amiss.
Yeah.
With all these things, and there seems to be consensus that people agree on in that area with this.
Yeah. Well, you have so many other pieces out there. Can we talk about some of your other writing?
Sure.
Now, you clearly have watched the show that I'm just not on the bandwagon yet, and I haven't seen it. I have not yet seen HBO's Looking.
Yeah.
That's pretty much sums it up. I could just go with what you just said in one word, but this is what you actually wrote. This is a snippet from your...
See, now I'm going to get nasty emails, but go ahead.
That's what this show is all about. You wrote this, quote, like those mostly forgotten cheesy 1990s gay movies that we watched because they put us in a fishbowl and were pretty much all we had as media representation, and also had dark sets and muted tones and lots of erasure songs. Looking spends all of its time telling us what we already know. We are men, we are gay men, and we like to have sex with other gay men. If the show were about straight guys, it would be 60 seconds long and a beer commercial. I'm getting the sense you're not a huge fan of HBO's Looking.
No, I'm not. You think? Was that how you read that?
That's how I, you
once
know.
Once again, see, I would respond to your negative comment and say, you misrepresented me. I love this show. HBO writers, if you need somebody, I'm here. I'm free. Love your show. I love to poke. First of all, there's a lot of brilliant writers and brilliant ideas and brilliant sitcoms and brilliant dramas on TV and brilliant movies that I hold something on HBO up to a high standard. And or any cable, you know, because or any TV show, any channel, any TV station. And because they do have everything at their access, they can get the bright, best writers in the world. And I feel as if looking, although people tell me it's gotten better, I watched three episodes, and I feel as if they just didn't develop the characters very well, and they seem to be just wanting to do a show that showed gay men and with a lot of gay references all the time. There's gay references constantly, whether it's Facebook or Grindr or hooking up or buddies or whether somebody's circumcised or blah, 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 but they didn't really develop the characters into people who are particularly interesting. And I already know I'm gay, so I don't really need to go on the show to figure that out. I want, if I'm going to see a show that features gay characters, which are now all over TV, I want them to have really compelling storylines that I can be involved with and get to know them, whether it's in a comedy form or a drama form.
Right.
I want to really get to know them and appreciate what they're going through. And I don't see a whole lot of that in looking.
Which begs the question, and I almost am nervous to ask, is the show even for us? Because I have to tell you, what annoys me immensely, and again, I haven't seen it, so I'm just not there yet. I just don't much care. I'm pretty tapped out right now on new shows. But my straight friends who have contacted me and insisted that I watch it because it's such an amazing representation, but then I've never heard that from any gay person at any point that they're amazing
representations. I don't think any gay person would actually say that.
Yeah.
I think they might say, I enjoy it because I like watching gay men on TV, but we've moved past this. That's what I said about those 90s movies. We didn't have anything else.
Right.
So we would watch these horrible, and they were horrible. I mean, granted, you know, like Kiss Me Guido or The Lonely Hearts Club, those are some of the names. And
Latter Days. It's all about the gay Mormons in Latter Days.
Yeah, that one was horrible. And no offense to whoever did it, but my God, that movie was horrible. And but that's all we had.
Right.
And they were usually very low budget, but we watched it because it was a man always searching for love, and there was a lot of sex scenes and so forth. And it seems like with the advent of, it started with Will and Grace, which put us in prime time, and I think nobody should underestimate how powerful the mainstream is. And to have a show about gay people that's in prime time, a sitcom that's in prime time, was phenomenal.
Yeah.
And I think since then we had Brokeback Mountain, and of course there were a few wonderful gay movies in there. They didn't probably receive a lot of attention in the straight community, which you need in the mainstream community. And that would be like My Beautiful Laundrette and those films, and a lot of those films. But when we had Brokeback Mountain, that sort of broke that barrier because it was so immensely popular in the mainstream world with two very, very popular, wonderful actors in it.
Yeah.
So I think we've moved on from that. And Weekend, by the way, the guy who is in charge of looking, Weekend was a charming, bittersweet movie. And I think it's very hard to compress what he did in that film in a half-hour time slot, which Looking has. I think it's too short.
You have a thing for Brokeback Mountain, I must say, because right there in the introduction to The Gay Couple's Guide to Wedding Planning, you write this, quote, "You've been dreaming about this wedding since you rewrote the ending of Brokeback Mountain to give those bucking broncos a happily ever after cowboy-themed affair."
Yeah, you do your research. Plus, I'm in love with Jake Gyllenhaal. So,
there you go.
I'm just waiting for him to finally come out and contact me. So does he listen to your show?
He hasn't written in lately, but that doesn't mean he could be a closet listener. We get those a lot.
Okay. Well, I want him to come out first. And yeah, I have a little thing for him. He's my dream date.
Well, let's play this out a little bit. Let's factor Jake Gyllenhaal into this. So now, because I'm going to keep going with the quote from the intro to this book, and maybe I'll improvise a little. Now that it's your turn, sit down together, you and Jake Gyllenhaal, and figure out what kind of wedding you desire. Since there are two of you, you, David, and Jake Gyllenhaal, you're going to discover that a lot of your plans are of no interest to Jake and vice versa. Something called compromise is about to play a huge part in your life, so get used to it. So would you indeed like to plan some sort of cowboy-themed wedding with you and Jake Gyllenhaal?
No.
No.
No, because he's been there and it didn't go well.
Right. It really did.
It really did not go well. So it was downhill after the tent. And, you know, that was great. That was the honeymoon. But after that, it was not really a good match. So, no, I think Jake would be a very romantic picture. Central Park,
Nice.
In the snow, something
okay.
like that. I yeah. And of course, whatever Jake wants. I you know, he's the more feminine one in this relationship. So.
What do you mean, whatever Jake wants? I just read this intro about compromising, and it just became whatever Jake wants.
Well, he's Jake.
He's
I mean,
Jake.
You know, something tells me he wouldn't be able to plan a wedding. I just, you know, if it was, there's other guys who would probably be in charge, but I don't think Jake's one of them.
Okay. All right. Well,
I think
well.
He'd need help. He'd want to just worry about his outfit and staying beefed up, which I would care about.
And thus, the winter wedding that you planned, very curious to me, but we can attack that a different day. It is such a significant time right now, obviously, around marriage equality. I would imagine that you are casting quite the critical eye on everything going on across the country as someone who has written quite extensively on planning gay weddings.
Yes, and I just wrote another piece for the Huffington Post, and it's not in there yet because I don't normally, we were talking about comments earlier on under pieces, and I've written 4 books. I don't try to get involved with reviews that people write online anymore because they aren't professional, meaning anybody can go on and write a review. But I did happen to notice that the overall rating for my last wedding book went down a notch. So I looked at a review, and there's only a few reviews for it, and a guy gave me 1 star. And I actually looked up his name and found him on – this is me. This is how obsessive I get. found him on Facebook because I wanted to see if he was a real person, because people do lie about their age when they their names when they write reviews.
Sure.
And he was, and there was actually a picture of my book on his Facebook page. So he's a very young guy, so he's obviously getting married, and he said that, among saying how much he hated the book, he called me a sad old queen.
Ooh.
And it really disturbed me, because that's a personal attack that has no business being in a review, in a review for anything. That has, if it's one thing to not like something I've done.
Right.
But to call me a sad old queen because he didn't like my book, and and that was just an assumption I must be a sad old queen, is just nasty, derogatory, and has no place in our community. And especially when the irony is that, you know, he's planning, you know, he said, and then he went on to say that I've never been there. It looks like that way. I'm just writing about it because I'm a sad old queen who's never, you know, been lucky enough to get married. And that sort of reminded me of the way that sometimes the younger generation looks at the world, like, and doesn't understand that, well, if he's getting married, which would be unfathomable 10 years ago, he should be acknowledging all the people who got us here.
Right.
And celebrating that and having some sense of history surrounding his big day and his event and this time in history, and not name-calling other people, other gay people who were before him. And I'm not really specifically talking about me. I'm just talking about the whole older generation.
Yeah.
who, you know, I have friends who have struggled all their life to create gay marriage, to make it legal. I mean, that's what they fight for. And I'm part of that in that I've written books on it, and then to just dismiss me as a sad old queen while he's doing something I couldn't do when I was his age seems to be a little bit hypocritical and kind of hateful. And that I don't appreciate on a very serious, to be serious. I think that's just, we don't need that.
All
we're
right.
not evolving if we're turning into what we despise.
And no place in a review. I'm confused as to how the two are even connected. It's like, did he purchase the book and then wanted to do name calling? It's a little bizarre to me.
Well, I just think people like to do name calling because
yeah.
they can, and that you see that more common. You know, if you look at the comments under my looking review, you see some of it in there.
Right.
And I'm used to that. That's fine. But in a review, if you're officially they don't belong in discussions either.
Right.
But unfortunately, there's nothing we can do about that, except to eliminate them.
Right.
But in reviews, they really don't belong there. If you know, that's, I was a professional reviewer. If you're going to review something, you really review it. You do not review the person.
Exactly.
And that, there's, nobody has any business doing that.
Yeah. Well, we must conclude. I would be remiss if I did not ask, how is DJ, the dog who rescued you?
He is right here next to me, as he usually is. He just had surgery in December. He had disc disease, so he had to have two discs almost completely removed. But he's healing beautifully. That's not in the book. That happened after the book came out. And he is still rescuing me, sitting right here next to me, sleeping.
There you
and
go.
Wondering why I'm on the phone, probably.
Well, I should say for folks who have not purchased it, and I actually do have a copy.
You do?
I do. I do my research. I know what I'm doing.
Oh, my gosh. Okay.
But stunning pictures, and I love the pictures all throughout the book, but I also love just how much you put yourself out there as someone who has experienced depression and mm-hmm. has forged this really, you know, it's so funny. I want to say a unique relationship with a pet, but so many of us who have had a pet, you know, see our own relationships with our pets, even as yours is unique, because we all have unique ones. And so you really put yourself out there in quite the authentic way that everyone can access.
I think that if people like this book, and many people have written me very sweet things about it, it's because even though I wrote it specifically about my dog, I think it's about everybody's animal.
Yeah.
And because everybody I know who loves an animal, whether it's a dog or a cat or a bird or a horse or whatever it is, they've all written me and they all have their own stories and they're just as unique.
Yeah.
And they're just as fascinating, and we just truly, truly love our animals. And I think that my story is no different. I just wrote it down.
Right.
Because what I tend to do is write, and other people paint and so forth and so forth. And I think it's a universal love that any animal lover has. And that's part of why I wanted to do it, because I was so intensely, you know, love my dog, and I know so many other people do, that I wanted to write a story that's my story but also for everyone.
Yeah. I read it, and then I looked at my cat and said, what's wrong with you? Why can't you provide what DJ provides? So it's something we're working through. We're working through it. Well, the name of the piece that inspired this conversation, Everything That's Wrong with Gay Dating Apps in One Extended Profile, we'll provide a link. You guys can find it over on the Huffington Post, and you can see all of David's other pieces, including an upcoming one where we're going to talk about name calling. David, keep writing, man.
Okay, and look for me on Grindr and Scruff. I'll be there.
See you there.
Okay, thank you so much.
All right, folks, and we are back. Well, a little bit of time left on this week's episode, so let's get to some LGBT news and maybe a little bit of my views on them. In South Carolina, South Carolina's House of Representatives just this past week approved a funding cut of nearly $70,000 to two state colleges. Why, you ask? Because they include LGBT subject matter in their freshman reading curriculum. After the University of South Carolina Upstate selected a gay author's award-winning graphic novel and memoir as part of their freshman reading list, and it's an optional list, by the way. This is not mandatory. It's an optional list. And the College of Charleston assigned a gay poet and professor's work as reading for their English 101 course. A group of conservative lawmakers sought to punish the schools by cutting $17,000 from USC Upstate's funding and $52,000 from the College of Charleston's state allocation. The funding cuts, which were included in the general budget passed by the House, can be considered retaliation for the two schools' inclusion of autobiographical books by two out authors in their freshman reading, which is according to the Republican representative who proposed the cuts. This is Representative Gary Smith, and he told CNN last week, quote, "I think the university has to be reasonable and sensible to the feelings and beliefs of their students. That was totally ignored here. I was trying to hold the university accountable. Their stance is, even if you don't want to read it, we'll shove it down your throat. It's not academic freedom. It's academic totalitarianism," end quote. That, my friends, as someone who is a college professor, which, by the way, so many of you write me every week and say, what is it you do during the week? I'm a college professor. This is what I do. This story kills me. It kills me. At no point does a college professor in creating a curriculum think, hey, what I'm doing right here, that might result in my funding being cut for my entire university. You're feeling a little divorced from that, trust me, when you're creating a class, when you're creating a syllabus. So the fact that the South Carolina House of Representatives has connected these two things is just insane to me. This fall at Baldwin-Wallace University, where I'm a professor, I'm actually going to be teaching a freshman seminar, which is optional, called, I swear to you, I'm not kidding, it's called This Course is So Gay, and it's looking at the pride and pitfalls of the modern LGBT cultural movement. That could maybe have some effects for Baldwin-Wallace. I mean, we do get federal and state funding, as most colleges do. We're not a state university, so that's a little bit different. But no professor anywhere is sitting and thinking, yeah, my course material, that might result in my entire university's funding getting cut. It's just crazy to me. It's crazy to me. By the way, again, reminding you that the University of South Carolina's upstate's inclusion of the LGBT book is an optional freshman reading list. And they will lose $17,000 if this goes through. It's crazy. It's crazy. The budget with the college funding cuts included now moves on to the state Senate, where it will be assigned to and debated in committee before possibly reaching the Senate floor. If the budget passes the Republican-controlled Senate, it would go back to the desk of Republican Governor Nikki Haley, who has yet to indicate whether she would approve the cuts. We will keep you posted on that going on in South Carolina. In Chicago, five Chicago City Council members stand to be outed as gay next month by the Chicago Dispatcher, a monthly newspaper that focuses on issues relating to the taxi industry. I know, it's weird, right? In an editorial titled, quote, Five Secretly Gay Aldermen, end quote, which was published online last week, the Dispatcher publisher George Lutfulla wrote that the paper, quote, learned that five of the city's 50 aldermen are closeted homosexuals. He threatened to disclose their names in next month's newspaper unless a list of demands were satisfied in the interim. Among those demands were that the city ban commercial ride-sharing permanently for a host of reasons, or else subject ride-share drivers to the same regulation as taxi drivers, and all these other taxi-related demands. And they have connected these demands to outing five of the aldermen. So that's still where we're at, where the threat of being outed as gay can satisfy the demands of the taxi industry. Wow. The editorial further claimed that the five aldermen in question lied to their constituents about their, quote, gay lifestyle. As examples of their hypocrisy, that editor joked, quote, a couple of them watch Duck Dynasty while eating carryout from Chick-fil-A, which I think is a joke, but it's not actually funny, so he should work on that. Statewide LGBT rights group Equality Illinois issued a statement saying it, quote, strongly condemns the editorial as it suggests there is something shameful about being a lesbian, gay, bisexual, or transgender public official. So we will see what happens there. So yeah, taxi industry really getting involved with LGBT equality. It's a bizarre story. It's just a bizarre story. CPAC. So CPAC was last week, the conservative coalition of just lunacy. The Conservative Political Action Conference is what, you know, it's actually called. But conservative Ben Carson let loose on gay marriage during his Saturday CPAC speech. And I laugh because so many of the speeches at CPAC were just so ridiculous and so anti-gay. But Ben Carson really, I think he might have won. I don't know if there were winners. I know there was a straw poll, so there's that. But I think he won. He said this, quote, as you know, I'm not a fan of political correctness. I still believe – oh, sorry, I should interject there. When he said that, everybody started cheering, so this is what we cheer for. He went on to say, quote, I still believe that marriage is between a man and a woman. He went on to add that the political world is full of ideologues, and the only people that can stop them are the American people. While he believes gay people are entitled to their rights – why can't it just be a period there? Why can't he just say, hey, I believe that gay people are entitled to their rights? But no, it's CPAC, so he went on. He drew the line at extra rights that alter the institution of marriage. This is what he said, quote, of course gay people should have the same rights as everybody else, but they don't get extra rights. They don't get to redefine marriage. So they don't get extra rights, but they should have the same rights, and I'm just going to keep talking till people cheer because it's CPAC, and so I don't like political correctness. Yay! And the crowd goes wild. and that's CPAC. Now, this is not his first time saying some pretty nutty things. Back in April 2013, he stepped down as the commencement speaker for Johns Hopkins University School of Medicine after he made some gay marriage comments that sparked outrage. This is what he said then, quote, "It's a well-established fundamental pillar of society, and no group, be they gays, be they NAMBLA, be they people who believe in bestiality, it doesn't matter what they are, they don't get to change the definition. Be they gays, be they NAMBLA, be they people who believe in bestiality, it doesn't matter what they are. They don't get to change the definition." So there's that. So he won CPAC, in my opinion, and the crowd again went wild. Here's another winner of this past week. LGBT people have been blamed for the September 11th attacks, tornadoes, earthquakes, and more, and now we're being held responsible for Russia's invasion of the Ukraine. Scott Lively, the right-wing minister who has praised Russia's gay propaganda law and played a key role in crafting Uganda's draconian anti-gay statute, he wrote in a WorldNet Daily column, quote, "The greatest point of conflict between the U.S. and Russia is the question of homosexuality. I believe even the conflict in the Ukraine is being driven to a large extent by this issue, at least on the part of the Obama State Department and the homosexualist leaders of the European Union." I didn't even know that was a word. Am I a homosexualist leader? I want to put that on a business card. If that's a word, that's kind of exciting. So from here on out, we're calling it "This Show is So Homosexualist." In good news, I want to throw some good news out at you. Earlier this week, the New York City Department of Education unveiled guidelines designed to better accommodate and protect transgender students in all New York City public schools. The guidelines encourage schools to use a student's chosen name and pronouns whenever possible, including on student IDs, with the notable exception being on official documentation such as a transcript. Additionally, the guidelines advise schools to avoid requiring students to use locker rooms, restrooms, and other accommodations that conflict with their gender identity and expression. Nicely done, New York City Public Schools. As we have covered countless times on the show before, our LGBT youth are disproportionately in danger of all sorts of health risks and bullying and everything that we all know but aren't doing enough about, and in particular, our trans youth are struggling enormously. So New York City taking a huge step to ensure the safety of our trans students. That is a very, very big deal. There are some other stories out there. There's a Fox sportscaster who claims anti-gay discrimination, but I'm not even really going to give him the time of day, so I'm just going to move on from that. But apparently anti-gay discrimination is a thing, but who am I? I'm just a homosexualist, so there's that. Hey, we have a very exciting show for you next week. Next week, we're going to be focusing our entire episode on the new Here TV sitcom called From Here On Out. I watched the first two episodes. It's hilarious. The creator and the star, Terry Ray, is going to be on the show. The director, Sam Irvin, is going to be on the show, and that's going to be a blast. So you will tune in for that next week. For this week, we must, of course, thank Kristen Ellis Henderson. Just adore her. And, of course, to David Toussaint. Check his column out over there in the Huffington Post. Thank all of you for listening. Of course, drop me an email. Just send it on over to ken@thisshowissogay.com. I'll respond. That's what I do. I respond to each and every email. So you send it, I respond. If you have any guest suggestions, please send them on over. We're always looking for new guests. And that is it for this week. Get out there, folks. Go do whatever it is that you do. Use your strengths, whether you are penning a column, whether you are writing a song, whether you are going on a cruise and just talking up issues of equality. Whatever it is that you do to use your strengths to make a difference for your LGBT and ally brothers and sisters, get out there and do it. And while you're doing it, please remember, why be gay when you can be so gay?